Roger Skibben is reporting for Lyle Vann. Our next news as it happens, next scheduled news at 4:30 with Lester Smith. 4:15 on WOR, Radio 710, the talk of New York. The big curtain is going up. You're just in time for Bob and Ray.
Ready in progress, and we want to welcome you here as we take over another afternoon and approach the end of the week.
Microphone on here?
Good. I think it is, anyway.
What did I hear? A general can trigger the nuclear bomb? I didn't know that.
I thought I heard.
Oh, boy.
My word.
I don't have enough worries. Always something to keep me up at night. Say, you know, some of you may have read in the paper that people in Detroit are planning to hold the biggest parade in the history of the world this spring. I know you've read that. It's the major event of their bicentennial celebration. So we've sent our correspondent Wally Ballou out to Detroit for a report on how the parade plans are coming along. And we're going to switch now to Wally to see what he has for us.
Lee Ballou speaking directly from a curbstone on Woodward Avenue in Detroit, and with me is Mr. Logan Driftwick, a member of the planning committee for Detroit's big bicentennial parade that's scheduled May 2nd. I understand the marchers will be coming right down this street, Mr. Driftwick.
Should I talk right into this?
Yeah, right here.
Well, we're not exactly...
I'll hold the microphone. All right. Just talk.
We're not exactly sure where they'll be marching, Mr. Ballou. You see, when we decided to make this the biggest parade in the history of the world, we didn't stop to think that it might require a longer street than we have here in Detroit.
Oh, I see. That could present problems.
Excuse me, but I might just mention that Woodward Avenue, where we're standing now, is an extremely long street.
Uh-huh.
But our parade still won't quite fit onto it, so we'll probably have to put some of our marches into the alleys off to the sides here. And the only alternative would be to have the front end of the parade march right across the International Bridge into Windsor, Ontario. And that seems kind of dumb because Windsor's in Canada, and they're not even having a bicentennial over there, so I don't think that would work.
At least you seem to be considering every aspect of the thing, Mr. Driftwick. I think you...
No, not really. We've still got a few guys on our planning committee who say that if this is going to be the biggest parade in history, then we ought to have every able-bodied person in Detroit marching in it.
And you don't think that's practical?
No, of course not. If we get everybody who lives here marching in the parade, then that doesn't leave anybody to stand on the curb and watch it.
So the spectators will all have to be brought in from out of town, I guess.
That's right. Then there was some talk of setting up an exchange program with Cleveland. The deal was that we'd send our whole population to watch their parade if they'd send theirs to watch our parade. But that would have created problems, too. For one thing, the Cleveland people would have to cancel almost 1 million newspaper deliveries so burglars wouldn't know they were all out of town.
Yeah, I guess there are all sorts of problems like that that the average person wouldn't ever think of. I assume you'll just attempt... I'm on the air here. I assume you just attempt to stage the biggest parade in history, but not with the entire population of Detroit marching in it.
Well, that seems like the most practical way. The only other possibility is to... is to film the bicentennial parade and then play it back on television after everybody has gotten home from marching in it.
That's an idea.
But by then, the people probably would be too tired to stay up for another 7 or 8 hours watching themselves on TV.
It seems as if you've had an awful lot of worries like that to consider in planning to stage the largest parade in the history of the world.
Yeah, but as one of our civic leaders said to me just the other day, what the heck? And by that, of course, he meant that Detroit hasn't had a World Series in several years. The Lions aren't going anywhere in the NFL. And we've never had a World's Fair or the Olympics. So why not have the biggest parade in the world instead?
Is that your only reason for doing this? Detroit hasn't had anything else of importance for a long time, so you're going to have a big parade instead? Is that it?
No, of course not. After all, this is the bicentennial. And we don't want Boston and Philadelphia and those places getting all the glory. We're proud of Detroit out here. We love this city. And we're going all out to show the country that we think this is the greatest town in America.
Well, that's certainly a worthy reason. Tell me this, Mr. Driftwick. Why are you holding your bicentennial parade on May 2nd instead of the 4th of July?
Are you kidding? Nobody stays around this town over the 4th of July. They all go up the lake or any place else they can think of just to get out of the town. But May 2nd happens to come on an average short weekend, so we figure we'll have a captive audience for our parade. You know, people who are stuck here in town anyway.
Right. I'm sure they'll be happy to turn out and show their civic spirit, since they can't leave town anyway. And thanks for telling us about the plans. This is Wally Ballou in Detroit. Back to Bob and Ray in New York. Mary Backstage, Noble Wife. The story of America's favorite family of the footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. With Mary still missing in Milan, Calvin has successfully led Harry and Pop back to the Hotel Raphael, where we see them now being greeted by Greg Marlowe, who arrived at their suite before them. We hear Greg.
Well, folks been on the town, have you?
Well, you'll never believe it. We've lost Mary, Greg.
Oh, no, don't.
No, it's right, Mr. Marlowe.
No, don't try to pull my leg. I'm in no mood for jokes.
No, it's
just
true,
come
Greg.
I from a very trying negotiation with the productori at the opera.
Well, you see, when we left, we went to see the opera. We saw the opera house. Mary
Isn't
was with
beautiful?
Us. Oh, it is. It's beautiful.
It really is.
We started to walk back. Calvin here said he knew the way back. And after several successful attempts, he found a way back.
You know, Mr. Marlowe, did you ever hear of deja vu?
Yeah, you mean the sense of being someplace before, or everything looks, similar, or...
Like you've been there before. Well, Calvin felt that way. He had the deja vu.
And I said, I've been here before, and I know just where the hotel is. Follow me. And they did, and here we are.
But on the way, we lost Mary. She strayed away from us
somewhere.
Well,
she knows. She's a grown woman. She knows the hotel where we are. Maybe she's shopping. Now, here's the thing. We're going to do La Traviata.
Right.
Mary will play Violetta. Are you familiar with La Traviata at all?
No, I've got to bone up on it, Greg. I
visualize you as Alfredo. You sing tenor, don't you?
Tenor, yes.
Right.
You got a part for me in it, Mr. Marlowe?
Well, the
Calvin,
next major part is Germont, or Germont. I don't know how that's pronounced. And it's a baritone, and either Calvin here or Pop will play that part. Well, I have a lovely baritone voice.
I'm more of a tenor myself, so I wouldn't be able to play that.
Well, let me just pencil in Calvin then for the part of Germont. I'll just write that in.
What part did you say I'll be playing again?
You'll be Alfredo.
Alfredo, uh-huh.
Alfredo.
And Mary will be?
Violetta.
Violetta.
You know, the story, La Traviata, are you familiar with it?
No, I'm not.
Well, Giuseppe Verdi wrote this back about 1853 or so.
Joe Green, you mean?
Translated out in English, it is Joe Green. I never thought of it that way. Giuseppe is Joseph and Verdi is Green. Yeah, Joe Green. Now I get it. Oh, yeah. Deja vu almost, isn't it?
No,
it
go ahead with the story, Greg. I'm getting very interested. What happened?
Well, you see, La Traviata, basically, you're familiar with the story of Camille?
Not too well. Yes, just a bit.
Well,
it's based on that.
It's an opera that's based on Camille.
Uh-huh.
And Violetta is the heroine, and she's the lead. And it's a wonderful place. As a matter of fact, when it first opened, it was a big flop, you know.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they just weren't ready for that story in the so-called modern dress back there in 1853.
Well, when are we going to begin rehearsals, Greg, and when do we open?
Well, we open, let me see, it's one thing I didn't discuss. Was it the 2nd of April?
2nd of April, on that paper there.
I have all these papers, yeah, April 2.
Well, that's 2 weeks from tomorrow.
April 2, the opera opens. At Mary playing Violetta, Harry backstage as Alfredo, and Calvin Hoogeveen as Germont.
And so Greg apparently has finalized his deal with La Scala for Mary, Harry, Pop, and Calvin to open 2 weeks from tomorrow. And you want to be with us tomorrow when we'll hear Greg say,
"Still no sign of Mary."
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage Noble Wife. Word Carr speaking.
We have some words for the New York Times, and then, boys and girls, it's Prodigy Street.
Boys and girls, let's all gather around now for another session of fun and learning on Prodigy Street. I know you little people are all in a great big hurry to become smarter than your mummies and daddies, so we're going to get started with today's lesson right away. Mr. Wise Old Owl is here with his blackboard and chalk, and I'll bet you're ready to teach the boys and girls something mighty interesting, Mr. Owl.
Oh, I sure am, Wally the Word Man. We're going to start today on learning how to multiply numbers. So first, I'll write the numeral 5 here on the Wise Old Owl blackboard. And then underneath that...
Excuse me, Mr. Wise Old Owl, but I think the boys and girls following along at home will notice right away that the number 5 looks a whole lot like the letter S that we were discussing last time.
Yes, I guess they do look a little bit like Wally the Word Man, and it's very interesting to notice that. But today, we're working on multiplication.
So now, under our number five.
Before we drop the subject of how much a five looks like an S, I know the boys and girls will want to think back to how we spelled the word Mississippi the other time, and how we laughed and laughed at all those S's it had in it. Remember, kids? M-I-S-S-I-S-S.
Please, don't go back and review all of yesterday's lesson again. I'm trying to teach the kids how to multiply now.
I certainly don't mean to be interfering, Mr. Weiselow. It's just that, modern education involves a lot of review and repetition in the preschool learning process, but since you majored in math, you wouldn't know that. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Now, boys and girls, I want you all to put a big number 2 right underneath your number 5, and then draw a line.
Well, look at that, boys and girls. See how the number 2 looks almost exactly like the letter Z we've already learned?
Look, I really wish you'd stop doing that. You see, it's confusing enough for little kids to learn something new without having their attention distracted all the time.
Well, letter Z is a tough one, so I like to go back to it whenever the chance comes up. Remember our words that begin with Z, boys and girls? We had zebra and zoo and Zimmerman.
Wally, don't you even care whether these poor kids ever learn to multiply 5 times 2?
Well, I guess it's a useful thing to know, but I can't see why it takes so long to explain. The answer is 10.
Well, that wasn't very nice of you to give the answer, Wally. I was going to let the children figure it out for themselves.
Yeah.
They've already learned that they have 5 fingers on each hand and 2 hands, so it was going to be fun to count all the fingers on both hands to get the answer. Now you've gone to spoil it.
That's your method of teaching multiplication? The other kids count on their fingers?
Well, just on the first problem. So they'll understand the theory. 5 fingers times 2 hands. It's simple multiplication.
Well, can't you just say it's 10 and be done with it? He makes it a big deal out of a little thing. 5 times 2 is 10. You don't even have to take your hands out of your pockets to figure that.
You know, I'm getting a very strong suspicion that you're making me look like a fool in front of millions of children.
Don't give me credit, fella. You're doing it all by yourself.
Okay, loudmouth. You've been shopping around for fat lip, but now you just bought one. So let's see how you like it.
Well, looks like the time's up for today's lesson, kids, but there'll be more soon on Prodigy Street. We'll be back.
Right at 10 under that 5 and 2, so you won't forget, kids.
Yeah, do that so you can stop counting your fingers. And be sure to join us next time for more fun and learning. Same time, same station on Prodigy Street. See you then, Mr. Weiselow.
Don't count on it.
Look at my doorstep, look at my doorstep, look at the bluebirds, look at the blackbirds, look at the good luck, look at the bad luck, look at the good luck and the bad luck, they're with never new bluebirds, new and new blackbirds, never new blackbirds, mingle with bluebirds, never new good luck, and could perch out there. I overheard
those birdies talking,
this is what they had to say. Now first the bluebird said, we gotta have sunny weather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. And now the blackbird said, we're birds of a different feather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. Now when they tossed it over, they let the bluebirds bring the rain. And then the blackbirds all agree to bring the sunshine back again. But you can't have rain or sunshine that lasts forever. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. Trouble, trouble round my door. Blackbirds by the score. Bluebirds came one day and said to the blackbirds, here are say. Now first the bluebirds said, we gotta have sunny weather. But you can't have rain or sunshine that lasts forever. Whip-a-boo-boo. You take the bluebirds, take the blackbirds, mix them together, you get fair weather. And that's the reason the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together.
Judy Dean and
Holly Simon.
Holly Simon's niece there. That's a great combination. Search for Togetherness, the touching story of people just like yourself who struggle to find happiness in a small Midwestern town where the steel mill has been closed permanently. As our scene opens today, young Dr. Honeycutt is in his furnished room upstairs above the cafe where Agatha is employed part-time. He has just finished closing his suitcase when Delbert Bushcroft enters on his way home from the bottled gas company.
Ah, Dr. Honeycutt, glad I found you in. I've just calculated what my living expenses will be after my forthcoming marriage to young widow Shipley. I'm afraid that I'll have to raise all the rents in this rooming house, including yours.
Well, it's interesting that you mention it just now, Bushcroft. I was just backing up to leave Roaring Falls. I think it's all for the best. The young widow Shipley brought up the subject of marriage last night, so I've decided to move my practice elsewhere, and I won't be needing this room.
It's interesting you should bring that up, Doctor. I just stopped by to tell you that the rent on your room is going to be up to $14 a week. However, I won't make the increase effective until the first of next month.
Well, that gives me plenty of notice, so I'd have to say you're being more than fair, Bushcroft. However, I imagine I'll be in the state capital by the first of next month. See, that's where I plan to set up my practice after I leave Roaring Falls.
I find that the most interesting thing you've mentioned, Doctor. The young widow Shipley and I will be moving to the state capital soon after our forthcoming marriage.
Oh.
Maybe we could all get together over there some evening.
Well, it's awfully kind of you to mention that.
That's the least I can do, Honeycutt. After all, I'm raising your rent by a full $3 a week.
Oh, don't give that a second thought, Bushcroft. We're all caught in a scramble to make ends meet these days. Besides, I'm moving out of this room anyway.
Well, I'm terribly sorry to hear that, Doctor. Would you reconsider if I didn't raise the rent a full $3 a week? Let's say something more on the order of a dollar and a half.
No, that really wouldn't change my mind. I've decided it's time for me to be moving on. As you may know, I've been seeing a good deal of the young widow Shipley lately.
Yes, there's been some talk around town.
Oh, I'm sure there has. Actually, I've never looked upon it as anything more than a passing flirtation. But last night, the young widow Shipley brought up the subject of marriage. So I decided to move my practice to the state capital.
Really? I've never been to state capital. However, I'm planning to move there soon after my forthcoming marriage.
Well, I think you'll like the town. It has a bit more of a cosmopolitan air than Roaring Falls.
That's what I've heard. And that's the principal reason I'm taking the young widow Shipley there to live soon after our forthcoming marriage. She's had a recent unhappy affair of the heart here in town, and, well, even though she claims it was nothing more than a passing flirtation, I think a change of scenery would do her good.
Well, it's interesting that you should bring up a subject like that. I'm moving to the state capital for the same reason.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe we could all get together over there some evening.
Well, it's awfully kind of you to mention that, but, you know, two's company, three's a crowd. Unless, of course, you happen to know some eligible young lady in the state capital you could fix me up with.
No, I'm sorry. I've never, ever been to the state capital. But it occurs to me that you know at least one eligible young lady right here in town, Honeycutt. Maybe your best bet is to stay in Roaring Falls.
I'd like to, Bushcroft, but I'm afraid it's out of the question. My rent here has just been raised, and I can't afford to pay it.
Really? I'm sorry to hear that, Doctor.
And so Delbert Bushcroft has at last begun to show concern over Dr. Honeycutt's financial problems. But how will the young widow Shipley react when she learns that Honeycutt can't even pay his room rent? Perhaps we'll find out in the next episode. Join us then for more exciting drama on Search for Togetherness.
We made a dreadful oversight at Pierce yesterday, huh?
We were so busy with Wally Blue out there covering the parade that we forgot to play the Paddy McCann song.
Oh, and that has become a ritual here every St. Patrick's Day for the many years that we've been here.
So we hope she's listening, our good friend, Paddy McCann.
There's a man by the name of Mike Hogan, and he's plaguing me out of me life. Now he has a big daughter named Bridget, and he wants me to make her me wife. She stands 6'4" in her stockings, sure herself of meself would make three. And whenever I stand out beside her, sure me elbow just touches her knee. I'm now Patsy McCann, will you marry me, daughter? Patsy McCann, she's a girl you should wed. 10 golden sovereigns down I will give you, a three-legged stool and a fine feather bed. St. Peter, St. Paul, and St. Patrick, all the pictures that have
hang on the wall. Sure, I'll throw them all into the bargain if you'll marry me, daughter at all. I married this big Bridget Hogan, and she's mine now for better or worse. Ah, but the blessings that she should have brought me, sure I think they've turned into a curse. For she bits and she nags and she flays me, and she ties me lest I run away. Sure the 6'4" beauty's a caution, and her father was worse for to say. Come on now, Patsy McCann, will you marry me, darling?
Stay tuned now for more Bob and more Ray in Radio New York over WOR New York.
And now, as a public service paid for by the Philanthropic Council to make things nicer, we invite you to spend another educational session with the idol of the nation's youngsters, Mr. Science. As we look in on the modern, well-equipped laboratory today, we see that little Jimmy Schwab is just arriving to watch Mr. Science perform his latest fascinating experiment.
Well, Jimmy, you've arrived just in time to watch me perform my latest fascinating experiment.
Oh, hot diggity, Mr. Science. This sure must be my lucky day. I also didn't catch the measles this morning from the kid next to me at school. And now, what fascinating experiment am I going to be privileged to behold?
Well, today, Jimmy, we're going to utilize our laboratory equipment to prove that all chemical elements expand in size when they're heated.
Holy mackerel, Mr. Science. I never dreamed that chemical elements did that. In fact, I tried a heated ice cube once, and it just turned into a puddle.
Well, ice isn't really a chemical element, Jimmy, but if you'd heated the water you obtained from melting your ice cube, then you could have seen it expand.
Gee, willikers, Mr. Science. I don't understand how I could have heated that water when it all spilled on the rug and soaked right in.
Well, that only happened because you weren't using modern laboratory equipment to perform your experiment. And water isn't really the best element to test for heat expansion anyway, but today you'll see how another common element increases greatly in size when it's heated. And to prove it dramatically, we're going to prove that the molecules and chemicals grow larger when they're warmed up. We're going to start our experiment with a test tube of chilled mercury.
Golly Moses, Mr. Science. What's that large, imposing piece of laboratory equipment you've utilized to chill the mercury?
That's called a refrigerator, Jimmy.
Great day in the morning. Wait till I brag to the bullies at the playground that I've seen one of those.
Yes, I'm sure it'll be a feather in your cap, son, but the most amazing part of this experiment is still to come. Now, notice how the mercury cooled in the refrigerator fills only about half our test tube.
Gee whiz, yeah. It's too bad you didn't have enough to do the experiment right.
Well, as you'll see in a moment, lad, this is all the chilled mercury we need to do the experiment properly. Now, notice how it's already beginning to rise in the tube as it warms to room temperature.
Great. Jumping Jehoshaphat, you're right, Mr. Science. Never before have I seen the working of such powerful magic.
Well, it's not magic at all, Jimmy. The structure of the molecules is changing. Now watch how the process is accelerated as I hold the tube over our laboratory Bunsen burner.
Holy Moses! I can see it growing with the naked eye. We'd better flee in panic before it spreads like the monster fungus from the lost planet I saw on television and consumes us all.
Oh, just calm down, son. Nothing like that's going to happen. Mercury just happens to be the element that expands most rapidly when it's heated. Some of the others change so little that the difference can only be seen with a microscope. But every form of metal, liquid, and gas does increase in volume when its temperature is raised.
Gee, then I'll bet you could even make some sort of device with an element in the tube to measure how hot the weather is. What a boon to mankind that would be, right, Mr. Science?
Yes, but a device like that already has been invented, Jimmy. It's called a thermometer. It has mercury inside.
No kidding. Well, maybe we could come up with an improved version using some of the stuff in this other bottle here. I'll hold it over the Bunsen burn and see if it expands.
No, don't do that, Jimmy. That liquid must never be heated. Put the bottle down,
it's
boy.
It's only half full. No. I want to see if holding it over the fire
will make
it...
I wouldn't.
This session with Mr. Science was brought to you as a public service, paid for by the Philanthropic Council to make things nicer. Today's broadcast was the last in our current series.
And now we welcome... welcome you again to The Big Scoop, the program that pays tribute to the outstanding accomplishments of the nation's working newspapermen. And here at our news desk, prepared to tell us about this week's Big Scoop Award, is our Big Scoop editor, Big Fred Scoop.
Thank you, Norman, and welcome to The Big Scoop. This week's handsome award certificate, together with a check for $15, goes to Osgood Breckley, a veteran sports writer for the Columbus, Ohio Morning Press-Dispatch World-Picayune. It was just a little more than a year ago that Breckley's Big Scoop began to take shape. On April 23rd, 1974, he was seated at his typewriter when the paper's sports editor approached him.
Breckley, you've really outdone yourself for sheer stupidity in this story you just put on my desk. Listen to what you wrote. Central and West Side met today for the City High School Baseball Championship. The final score was 7-2. Pete Sakeman, who won?
Oh, I'm sorry, Chief. It was Central. I had that scribbled down on my notes someplace, but I guess I forgot to put it in the story.
Frankly, I've often remarked that you're the biggest incompetent on the staff, but you seem to have gotten even worse the past few days. Is something on your mind?
Well, to tell you the truth, Chief, I think I've stumbled across the story that could become really my big scoop. There was something about Sunday's pro basketball game that made me suspicious. The Wildcats blew a 26-point lead in the last 30 seconds. And that's pretty hard for a team to do unless it's losing on purpose.
Breckley, you're skating on very thin ice when you make a statement like that. The owner of the Wildcats is also the publisher of this newspaper. So for your own good, I'd suggest you forget all about this suspicion of yours.
Well, I'm sorry, Chief. I can't do that. As a working newspaper man, I have a duty to the public. And they must fulfill that duty, regardless of the consequences.
And so Osgood Breckley began sifting bits of information. It would be his big scoop if he could prove that the local basketball team was throwing games. He went first to the head coach.
Coach, I have reason to believe that you're lining your pockets at the expense of a bunch of clean-cut young athletes. Any comment?
Are you miserable punk?
Next, Breckley paid a surprise visit on the team's star center.
Slats, I understand the fix is in. You're making a bundle from the syndicate. What do you want to say to that?
A rotten little pipsqueak.
And finally, he approached the Wildcats owner, who also published the newspaper.
Excuse me, sir, but I'm just wrapping up a story about bribery on the team that could send you to jail for a long, long time. How will you feel about going to the slammer?
Why, you insolent wretch.
Armed at last with the facts he needed, Osgood Breckley returned to face the sports editor of his paper.
Okay, Chief, you can start getting the headline ready for my big scoop. Just wait till you see the rumors and innuendo I've prepared to state without qualification.
Forget it, Breckley. The coach and players of the Wildcats have already filed suit against you for slander. On top of that, the publisher of this paper has ordered you fired, so wash up and clear out.
Okay, Chief, but at least I proved my point. When you stumble across a hot story, people who abhor freedom of the press will always try to stop you from printing it. That's the American way.
And so it was that Osgood Breckley used the facts he'd obtained to lose a $32 million lawsuit for slander. It was the largest judgment ever awarded in a case lost by a newspaperman. And that's why he's been chosen to receive this week's Big Scoop Award, appropriately inscribed to Osgood Breckley, a credit to his profession and a man whose story we've been honored to tell on The Big Scoop. Now the Auburn Motor Company, maker of fine cars up to but not including 1938, brings you another episode of The Gathering Dusk, a heartwarming story of a girl who searches for a happier future by dwelling in the past. As we look in on the Bessinger household today, Edna is in the downstairs kitchen preparing to make mock turtle soup out of her mock turtle. It's early afternoon, and Mr. Kloybeck, the leading exterminator in the village, is just arriving.
Oh, it's you, Village Pest Control expert Chloe Beck. I hope my urgent phone call didn't prompt you to bring along any deadly nerve gas in defiance of the Geneva Convention.
No, exterminators don't use any of the chemicals that are prohibited by international law, Miss Bessinger.
Well, I'm awfully glad to hear that. I'd hate to turn a man with young children over to the authorities as a war criminal.
Well, I'm sure I'd never fall into that category. All I do is drive my little truck around the village, getting rid of insects and rodents.
Well, that may be, but of course Adolf Hitler used to drive his little truck around Austria hanging wallpaper. And then he went on to worse things as soon as people let down their guard against him.
Well, I certainly don't see any basis for comparing my career with Hitler's. I have no interest in politics at all.
My, it's not a coincidence, neither do I. Of course, when Daddy was alive, he always made me go out and vote. But that was only because he didn't want anybody to get elected who might put an end to Prohibition. He figured it would be bad for business somehow.
Well, I suppose he held that view because he was a bootlegger. Those people were the only ones who thought ending Prohibition would be bad for business.
Well, as it turned out, they were right. I read somewhere recently that 15 million men were out of work in 1933. I hadn't even realized there were that many bootleggers in the country.
Well, I doubt if all the men who lost their jobs during the Depression were bootleggers, Miss Bessinger. It's just a coincidence that there was that much unemployment the same year Prohibition ended.
Well, I just don't know. I've always thought there must be some hidden connection between all those things that happened in 1933. That's why I've been so hesitant about having new wallpaper hung in the dining room.
Well, what does that have to do with it?
Well, 1933 was also the year that Hitler came to power, and I'd hate to think that my money was being used to start that whole business all over again.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I'm glad you told me you're not interested in politics, because there's no telling where that kind of logic might lead you, but is that all you've called me here to discuss?
No, not by a long shot, Village Pest Control expert Chloe Beck. I've really been in a snit all day because of that swarm of bugs here on the carpet. They're multiplying so fast that you probably can't get rid of them. I thought maybe you could at least tell me whether they're poisonous.
Well, I don't know what to say, Miss Bessinger. I don't see any insects on the carpet at all.
Well, I don't see how you can miss them. They're those big black ones. And notice how they've all lined up in even rows, like an army preparing to attack me.
Oh, I see what you're pointing at now, Miss Bessinger, but those aren't black insects lined up on your carpet. Just part of the design in the rug.
Oh, my stars. I do believe you're right, Village Pest Control expert Chloe Beck. I remember now that I ordered a plain dark red for this room, but that was during World War II when you had to take whatever you could get, and I just never noticed until today that I got a pattern with rows of black circles in it. My, you can't imagine what a burden of worry this lifts from my shoulders. I almost feel as if I'm no longer standing in the gathering dusk.
Can it be that Edna's miraculous escape from a plague of insects may at last enable her to find true happiness? Or will it only lead to further heartbreak when she realizes that she may be going buggy even if the house isn't? Join us for the next episode when Edna will go shopping for roach powder in the gathering dusk.
Our scouts have been searching the railroad and bus terminals for pathetic people who are down on their luck. And I want to give them all a helping hand from our generous Bob and Ray organization, just as soon as they finish telling you their heart-rending stories of misfortune. And Bob, why don't we begin with that odd-looking gentleman you have there beside you?
All right, we will, Ray. And we might mention that these people were all put up at the Bob and Ray Hotel during their stay here in New York.
Wonderful.
This is Mr. Sherwood Prouty of Yakima, Washington. And I understand you drove your old truck clear across the continent in the vain hope of launching a business career in New York, Mr. Prouty.
Yes, that's right. See, I had a whole truckload of Christmas trees left over from the lot I operated back home, and I figured that the people here in the city would grab them quick.
Well, I assume from what you're saying, there's very little market for Christmas trees in Yakima, Washington after Christmas?
That's correct. In fact, there's not even much of a market for them there before Christmas. Everybody's got so many evergreen trees around Yakima that, well, it would be pretty ridiculous for a person to buy another one.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought New Yorkers would grab up any kind of a tree just for the novelty of having a tree.
Even if it's a Christmas tree after Christmas, you mean?
Yes, and even if all the needles have fallen off. My theory was wrong. And now the city is threatening to condemn my truck as a fire hazard because it's full of old, dried-out Christmas trees.
Well, we can all appreciate what a terrible ordeal it's been for you, Mr. Prouty. So from our generous Bob and Ray organization, just for you, here's this lovely gift. A complete bolt of high-quality oilcloth from the Ozark Studio of Interior Decoration in Yellville, Arkansas. Notice it has little blue flowers on a solid pink background there.
Yes, I see that.
And let's move along to a lady with a hard luck story here. She is Mrs. Sonia Falconbridge of Paxton, Nebraska. And you're desperately trying to reach Paris, Mrs. Falconbridge, I understand, so you can have a reunion with your brother you haven't seen in 59 years?
That's right. Parnell signed up for the Army the day after we got into World War I. And he was shipped overseas before I even had a chance to say a proper goodbye.
Oh, it's a touching story. And I assume he decided to stay in Europe after the war ended?
No, actually, he stayed there because he never got his papers ordering him to come home and be discharged.
Mm-hmm.
We thought at first that it was just a foul-up in the War Department, but now they've gotten so much new paperwork that I doubt if they'll ever get around to finding Parnell's records. So it looks as if he's stuck in France for the duration.
Duration of his life, you mean?
Yes, and it may not even be legal for him to come home after he's finished his life. I haven't checked into that yet.
Well, in any event, it's truly a sentimental journey you're embarking on.
Yes,
and we want to see you on your way with this lovely gift, a handsome new saddle for your motorcycle with genuine fringed leather around the edge. I think it carries the endorsement of the Hell's Angels.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if it did, but that doesn't change the fact that I'm a 79-year-old woman who doesn't own a motorcycle.
Well, that's another of your personal problems we can't take time to go into now, man. Best of luck to you.
Right.
And a final hard luck story today will be told by Mr. Dewey Claiborne of Alma, Michigan. You want to get to Latin America so you can become a strolling mandolin player, Mr.
Well,
Claiborne?
That's right. I've seen a lot of movies that were set in Mexico and other places like that, and I noticed that whenever there's a romantic scene in a restaurant, a bunch of guys are always strolling around in big hats, providing the background music,
mm-hmm.
and there's usually a mandolin player in the crowd.
And that makes you think you'd stand a better chance of getting a job in Latin America than in Alma, Michigan, right?
Oh, yeah. In Alma, they wouldn't even let me in the high school marching band playing the mandolin, so I'm sure I couldn't get work there doing it on a full-time basis.
No. It sounds as if the opportunities are kind of limited. But have you decided which Latin American country it is you want to go to?
Yes, I'd like to go to the one where Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers always used to go. There are lots of strolling mandolin players there.
Well, wherever that may be, our generous Bob and Ray organization wants to help you on your way, and for you, this beautiful Oriental jardiniere, replica of a valuable piece from the time of the Ming Dynasty.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, it's from the time of the Han Dynasty, but it's still completely useless to a person in my situation.
You're welcome, sir, and enjoy it in good health. Now back over to Ray at our main anchor desk.
According to this note I've just been handed, our correspondent Wally Blue is standing by with a report from Coney Island. Could this be right at this time of the year?
Yep, he phoned in a few minutes ago. I don't know what it's all about, but I guess we'll check.
Let's find out then. Come in, please. Wally Ballou.
This is Venerable Wally Ballou speaking from Coney Island. And this, of course, is the playground of Greater New York. And on this winter day, there's one lone bather on the beach here. I've asked him to step up to our microphone. Would you give us your name, sir, please?
Yes, my name is Eugene U. Pfeiffer, and I live in Jackson Heights.
So I noticed you out here in your swimming trunks and beach towel as I was driving by on the way to work, and I could hardly believe my eyes.
Well, quite a few people come over to find out what I'm doing here. Cops, mostly.
Uh-huh.
Yes!
Well, what are you doing on a cold, windy day like this?
I just can't stand crowds, Mr. Blue.
Uh-huh.
So I always give this place a wide berth in the summertime. But then I come out here often during the winter to swim or just lie around on the beach.
Uh-huh.
I really have a place to myself. I don't have people kicking sand in my face, and there's no waiting in line at the hot dog stand or
uh-huh.
anything like that.
I can understand. The hot dog stand isn't open either.
That's right.
Well, it certainly is a novel idea, Mr. Pfeiffer, and it sounds as if you've kind of picked up a nasty cold out here in just your swimming trunks.
Yeah, I have a cold almost all winter anyway. I usually start sneezing before I get here. The bathhouses are closed in the winter, too.
You mean you drive out here from Jackson Heights in your swimming trunks?
No, I come by subway. Well, those platforms can be pretty cold and drafty this time of the year.
Achoo! You seem to have things fixed up here pretty comfortably, or as comfortably as you can. You've got your towel, beach umbrella, portable radio. What's the carton there, your lunchbox?
That's right. Would you care for a sandwich? I think the wife picked peanut butter for me today and jelly. Peanut butter and jelly, yeah.
No, thank you. As a matter of fact, I want to get out of here before I catch cold. I think you're starting to breathe on me a little bit.
Well, that's probably true.
Thanks for talking with me, Mr. Eugene Pfeiffer. And this is Wally Ballou at Coney Island, sending it back to Bob and Ray.
Now back to Bob and Ray.
All right. Thank you, Stan. Good night. We'll see you tomorrow. And that puts a ribbon around the Bob and Ray show for this Thursday.
It's a good one on the WOR Radio Mystery Theater tonight, right after the upcoming Fort Lewis News commentary. Ralph Bell stars in The Other Side of the Coin.
Ooh, so we'll see you tomorrow at 4:15. Until then, this is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumbs.
And this is WOR New York, an RKO General Station.